first this morning in number 7132, Curtis C. Flood against Kuhn and others. Mr. Goldberg.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, the issue in this case is the legality under federal antitrust and state statutory and common law of organized baseball's reserve system. To paraphrase Judge Waterman's opinion in the Court of Appeals, this is a scheme which binds every American professional baseball player to one team or its assignee for life, and which compels team owners to boycott the player property of another team owner, and to boycott any fellow owner, and to boycott the player himself and blacklist him who fails to abide by the agreement among the owners to eliminate competition in the recruitment and retention of personnel. The reach of the reserve system extends beyond the continental United States and even our new states, beyond the 24 major league clubs, which are defendants in this lawsuit, to 155 minor league clubs organized in 21 minor leagues, to the Mexican League, and even to Japan. An American player boycotted by organized baseball today is boycotted by Japanese employers as well. Perhaps it may be helpful to the court if I, having stated the issue, now review a few of the pertinent facts. On October 8, 1969, Curtis E. Flood, then a major professional ball player for the St. Louis Cardinals, was traded. His contract transferred and assigned to another National League Baseball club, the Philadelphia Phillies, as part of a multiplayer transaction between the two clubs. As Judge Cooper found in the district court, and I paraphrase him, at the time of the trade, he was 22 years old, a veteran of 12 years' service with the Cardinals, co-captain of the team by election of his teammates, and acknowledged to be a player of exceptional and proven ability. About that, the record is very clear. In his active service with the St. Louis Cardinals, he batted around 300, won several Golden Gloves competition, which is the competition for excellent fielding, and was regarded to be a great asset for that team, as evidenced by the fact that he was being paid $90,000 a year. Not a salary, as we know from reading the newspapers, that baseball owners throw away very lightly. The circumstances surrounding his assignment, or as Judge Waterman said in the Court of Appeals, to use baseball parlance, sale, are rather interesting as part of the background of this litigation. And perhaps it explains why he chose to use the courts to vindicate his rights. Although he had deep roots in St. Louis, Missouri, not only with the ball club, with which he had served faithfully for 12 years, he was also an artist who had an artist studio. He had two photographic studios there and franchises elsewhere. And he had many friends and family in St. Louis. He was not consulted about the trade. Quite the contrary. He received a form notice and then a telephone call. The form notice was a very cryptic one. The record itself does not really display what it actually is. It's a printed form. And in that printed form, there is a check mark. Your contract is renewed. Your contract, quote, has been transferred. You have been released from service. Perhaps I would like to suggest to your honors, you might want to look at the exhibits rather than the cold record to see how this form is filled out. I should say in all fairness to my distinguished brothers on the opposite side, you also received a telephone call. After the transaction was completed, not before, presumably he had relinquished all of his rights to any consultation or disposition of his destiny. When, at the age of 15, he signed a contract with the Cincinnati Reds without the assistance of an attorney, which was the practice in those days, and until very recently, until the 1970 contract. He signed his first professional baseball contract for an average salary of $4,000. He, of course, worked his way up the ladder, and when he was playing last, he enjoyed this very generous salary. The fact that he was an exceptional player, as Judge Cooper found in the district court, and Judge Waterman, speaking for the Court of Appeals, confirmed that finding, is illustrated by his batting averages. After he started to play full-time in 1962, he had been there since 1958 with the St. Louis Cardinals, his batting averages were in 1962, 296, 1963, 302, 1934, 311, 1964, 311, 1965, 310, 1965, 267, 1967, 335, 1968, 301, 1969, 285. I'm not a great mathematician, Mr. Chief Justice and Associate Justices, but this seems to me to be a batting average around 300. He was also the winner of several Golden Gloves awards. These are awards given to players for excellent in fielding. He got this notice, this form notice, without advance consultation, and then he got the telephone call telling him he had to uproot himself, his family, his business connections, and move to Philadelphia. On December 24, 1969, Mr. Flood wrote to the Commissioner of Baseball, responded to Mr. Kuhn, Bowie Kuhn, the Commissioner of Baseball, asserting his right to negotiate with teams other than Philadelphia and state. And it's a rather interesting exchange. This was his letter in part, the relevant part. Dear Mr. Kuhn, after 12 years in the major leagues, I do not feel that I am a piece of property to be brought and sold, irrespective of my wishes. I believe that any system which produces that vital result violates my basic rights as a citizen and is inconsistent with the laws of the United States and of the several states. The Commissioner of Baseball, Mr. Kuhn, replied, "Dear Kurt," this is faintly reminiscent to me of a unanimous decision of the Supreme Court which reversed the Hamilton case because a witness was addressed by her first name while other witnesses were addressed by their last name. Putting that aside, the letter read, "Dear Kurt, that while we agreed with the contention that as a human being, you are not a piece of property to be bought and sold, and this is fundamental to our society, could not see its applicability to the situation on hand. Faced with this sale, which he deemed to be an impairment of his legal rights, and the denial of his request that he be made a free agent at liberty to seek employment with other teams, and without subjecting the new employer to boycott by the team owners, he had no recourse, in his opinion, other than to mount this lawsuit. And this lawsuit challenges the reserve system which permits this to be done. Mr. Flood adhered to his refusal to play for Philadelphia during the 1970 season. So when Philadelphia sold its exclusive right to negotiate with Flood to the Washington Senators after the 1970 season concluded, financial necessity compelled him to acquiesce. So we have the reserve system, not unfamiliar to this court, because this court has passed upon it, I think wrongly, in two cases, and particularly Toulson. I think a very accurate description of the reserve clause is contained both in the district court opinion and in Judge Waterman's opinion for the majority of the Court of Appeal, for the whole Court of Appeal. Judge Moore filed a concurring opinion. Judge Waterman in the Court of Appeals described the reserve system as a system, and I quote him, which pursuant to a nationwide agreement, I shall say a word about that, clubs, baseball clubs, effectively restrict a baseball player if he desires to play professional baseball at all, to contract negotiations with that club that organized baseball which first employs or reserves him, or with that club's assignee club, and any subsequent assignee clubs to which in the parlance, and I'm quoting Judge Waterman, he has been sold or traded. There is a more extensive treatment of how the reserve system operates, citing the rules which govern the baseball rules in Judge Cooper's opinion in the district court. And while I disagree with his conclusion, I do not disagree that Judge Cooper correctly describes how the reserve system operates. Briefly, in addition to Judge Waterman's pungent and succinct description, it goes beyond that. No other club may bid for his services once he signs. He is not permitted to approach any other club. That's called the no tampering rule. A club which violates this rule is subject to boycott by the other clubs. In fact, any player that plays for another club which violates this rule is subject to discipline by the Commissioner of Baseball. And it also extends beyond what Judge Waterman did not deal with, clubs, the major league clubs. It extends to the minor league clubs. It extends to the Mexican League. It extends even to Japan. This is uncontradicted in the record. Now, Mr. Flood stayed out in 1970 and pursued this lawsuit, challenging the reserve system on several grounds. First, that it violates the antitrust laws of the United States. Second, that it violates the antitrust laws and common law of the several states. And third, that it violates the 13th Amendment to the Constitution of the United States, prescribing that indentured service as well as slavery should be not permitted. Now, having stayed out in 1970, as I have said, he was confronted with 1971. At that time, Philadelphia, the team that owned him, again, I quote, paraphrase Judge Waterman's opinion, the team that owns him sold him to Washington. He agreed to play for Washington. He was there for a few months, and we can all take judicial notice, I think, of what occurred, laymen, lawyers, and I believe this court. He tried. He had been laid off for a year. After trying for a few months in spring training and in the actual season, he was benched. He could not easily regain his skills, which is not difficult to understand, and he left. Now, the transfer to Philadelphia, the transfer from Philadelphia to Washington was accompanied by a stipulation between ourselves and opposing counsel that this would not prejudice this lawsuit. I'm well aware, however, that private people cannot stipulate a case for this court, but the transfer did not moot this case. In Radovich, the football case, this court held that the success of a boycott did not moot a case. And furthermore, he had experienced damages in 1970, and he had suffered impairment of his career. Now I turn to the reserve clause.
He indicated in his letter, I noticed in the record, in his letter in late 1969 to Mr. Kuhn, that Philadelphia had offered him a contract. What were the terms of that contract?
They
not,
offered
not
him,
all the details, but in
just
terms
they offered him an increase to $100,000 with salary and other benefits. But that was not what he was contesting. He was contesting being removed without his consent, and as his letter states, he didn't want to be treated as chattel property.
Right.
Question of principle.
I just wondered as to your...
Yes.
What you're now telling us about the about yes. the lack of mootness and about his damages in 1970.
Yes.
He was
offered
$100,000.
He was offered. It is not, by the way, new, although I have seen articles about it which indicate that this high-paid ball player did things, you know, that why did he do it when other ball players, who, by the way, despite all the stories in the press in the 5 years previous, had only averaged a little over $8,000 a year. Why this high-paid ball player did this? He did it, as he simply said, out of principle. He no longer wanted to be treated as chattel property. He made that decision on his own, and although he has been supported in this litigation by the Players Association, about which I shall later have reference, this was his decision. The record is very plain on that. In fact, he was told by the director, Mr. Miller, that he had a tough case. Nevertheless, he felt in good conscience he had to pursue it.
As a practical matter, though, he had no real chance of remaining in St. Louis and negotiating another contract with the St. Louis club. He would have had to go to one of the other teams, even if it hadn't been for the reserve.
But, Mr. Justice, provided this clause is legal, and I shall say it is not.
Even if it's not legal, if St. Louis is trading him, regardless of the reserve clause, they're not going to negotiate another contract with him.
He said that what he wanted was the opportunity as a free agent to negotiate his own deal, not to be traded, as this form that I have referenced indicates, without his consent. Now, the reserve clause has been in existence 100 years, long antedated any union that the ballplayers formed which I shall talk about in the labor exemption, with one important modification. In 1965, the reserve system was extended for the first time to potential new players who had never signed an agreement with any team. And typically, these are teenagers just graduated from high school or who have dropped out of high school. This had never been done. For this category, not in the minor leagues, they, until 65, enjoyed the privilege of negotiating their first contract. That no longer exists. They have a semi-annual draft. There is another factor which I shall advert to when I talk about the so-called labor exemption. Judge Cooper found that the baseball's reserve system is not presently collectively agreed to. Citation is in my brief. I shall not burden you with the citation. Now, Flood decided to sue. He challenged it, as I have said, on several grounds.
Mr. Justice, may I ask you, suppose it had been collectively agreed to, would your position be any different?
No. And I shall discuss that when I come to the labor exemption.
I hope you're going to get to that.
I will move fast. Because of the shortness of time. We have these three propositions. On the first, the antitrust laws, we are confronted, obviously, with two decisions of this court. Federal baseball decided in 1922, and Toulson decided in 1953.
And they would have to be overruled.
They would have to be overruled. They should be overruled. They should be overruled for very good reasons. They should be overruled because the first one, federal baseball, was not, as Judge Friendly has said, Justice Holmes' happiest hour. Indeed.
But I take it, Mr. Justice, those both dealt with a issue of statutory construction, didn't it?
Yes. But even then, it showed, I doubt that Justice Holmes had ever seen a ball game.
The court doesn't readily overrule matters of statutory construction.
Yes, but it has. And quite recently, as I shall point out in a moment, in reading from an opinion written by Justice Stewart for a unanimous court in construing a statute. And that is a case that put aside the Collins versus Hardiman. The federal baseball, in fact, was abandoned by Justice Holmes the very next term after he had written it. And Toulson was a per curiam, which merely said that, well, we've done it, even though we think it's wrong because interstate commerce has changed, well, we ought to leave it to Congress. And the court was troubled at that time with whether or not prospective rulings could be made. That problem, of course, has been settled by this court even quite recently. And I shall mention that. Now, I say to you very simply, I shall not belabor it, that federal baseball was wrong. The development of the law of what constitutes commerce has proceeded the pace. And no one would doubt that baseball is engaged in interstate commerce. This court in Radovich, this court in Schubert Theaters, this court in the boxing area have all characterized sports, if they're so called, as in interstate commerce. Baseball, indeed, is in interstate commerce in a very big way. It's a tremendous institution. It sends people all over the country and into Canada. It realizes enormous revenues from television. I think I saw the other day that in the national contract, television rights. They realized $41 million, and then it's supplemented by local contracts. Now, we have here a question of stare decisis. Now, Stuart, when I mentioned that I thought that this had been put to rest involving a statute...
Mr. Justice, just before you start on that... Do you think Federal Baseball and Toulson indicated that the baseball wasn't engaged in interstate commerce, or is it that, labor isn't an article of commerce? Services isn't an article of commerce as a matter of statutory construction and the intent of Congress. Would you just say that labor is an article of commerce,
yes,
or not?
It depends on what way labor is treated. Labor should not be an article of commerce. Clayton Act says it should not be a commodity.
Well, is Flood different?
Yes.
Why?
Because he's been treated as a commodity, as everybody is under the reserve rules. He's not treated as labor, as we traditionally understand labor people to be treated. Free American workers,
but in
determining
any event,
their own destiny.
I gather Radovich settled that.
Yes, it did. The same issue was raised in Radovich, and decided against the football owners, which brought Radovich, which were involved in the Radovich decision in this court. It was argued in Radovich. And I do not know what prompted this court to take certiorari. I have not assumed that the purpose of the grant, when this necessarily follows, if it is treated as a labor exemption, which I shall talk about, if it is decided that the labor exemption, so-called, applies, then it certainly applies to football. They have a union. It certainly applies to hockey. And the consequences of a decision holding that... that the labor exemption applies to baseball necessarily means that it applies to all other sports, so-called sports. By the way, it's very interesting. When you read this record, as I know you have or will, Bowie Kuhn, the commissioner of baseball, does not refer to it as a sport. He refers to it as entertainment. Entertainment, it's governed by your decision in Schubert, which says that it's subject to antitrust regulation. The decision, Justice Stewart, that I mentioned in a statutory construction is your own in Griffin versus Breckinridge. Perhaps I shall read only a few sentences. Whether or not Collins versus Hardiman construes the Civil Rights Act was correctly decided on its own fact is a question with which we need not here be concerned. But it is clear in light of the evolution of decisional law that have passed since the case was decided that many of the constitutional problems there perceived simply do not exist. Justice Holmes conceived there was a constitutional problem. Little reason remains, therefore, not to accord to the words of the statute, not to accord to the words of the statute, their apparent meaning. I move quickly to the next point. I think it ought to be overruled. It's an anomaly in the law. Every commentator has said it's an anomaly in the law to adhere to Toulson and to Federal Baseball as improperly decided. Now I move quickly to the next point, and that is state law. Peculiarly enough, as Judge Waterman says, they were on the horns of a dilemma. If federal law did not apply because it was not interstate commerce, why should not state law apply? And Judge Waterman said, contrary to the district court, which said it was preempted, Judge Waterman said that it was interfered with interstate commerce. I take it this has no foundation whatsoever. The decisions of this court are plenty and ample on the subject that state laws, which carry out the purposes of the great federal statute, the Sherman Act, which are not inconsistent, ought to be applied. And that is the law. Senator Sherman, the author of the Sherman Act, said that our law is designed to supplement, not displace, federal law. There is no preemption here, express or implied. There is no conflict, nor has any court found one. As Waterman says, there is a necessity for uniformity, but there was no inquiry into the state statutes to determine whether there was. We have listed the state statutes and briefly summarized. They are the same as the Sherman Act, those states that have adopted it. So, the decision, for example, in the Continental Airlines case covers that. Finally,
Has the petitioner left baseball? Yes,
he left. He left now.
Is the case moot, therefore?
No, it is not, because the 70 season is a season where he has a right to recover damages because he returned later. And he also has a right to decide if he wants to go to the minor leagues or Japan, which are subject to the same rules. I shall say one word. I shall take a few more minutes of my time and cut it off of rebuttal.
Your rebuttal time Your time is completely consumed, but we'll extend it 3 minutes and enlarge yours 3 minutes, Mr. Porter.
There's nothing to the baseball argument that a newfound affection for the collective bargaining and the Labor Act. I share that affection. In fact, I shared it for many, many years. Under the decisions of this court, this is hardcore violation of the antitrust law. This is a group boycott and a blacklisting. All owners under the rules are obligated not to deal with a player if he is on a reserve list. He's blacklisted, not only here, but in Mexico and in Japan. And this is the most obvious restraint of trade known to man. I put a simple illustration. As your honors well know, I once represented the steelworkers. Let me put a proposition. Suppose the steelworkers union, it would never do this, agreed with U.S. Steel that if a man signed up, he had to work for U.S. Steel all his life, and if Bethlehem employed him, if he left, if Bethlehem employed him, U.S. Steel would not supply parts for their fabricating or steel for their fabricating operations. Is there any doubt in anybody's mind that that would be a per se violation? Not at all. Finally, so there's nothing to this labor exemption. As the court said recently, the court said in Pennington, Justice White's opinion, you cannot just say conditions of employment, wages, you have to interpret the terms. This is purports to be a condition of employment. Servitude is not a condition of employment, nor is slavery. And can you conceive any union being charged with a failure to bargain because of this? I cannot conceive that. Furthermore, this goes beyond the bargaining unit. The opinion, Justice Brennan, that you just wrote, confirming Pennington, because it covers the minor leagues and it goes beyond that. So it gets out of the bargaining unit. And for all these reasons, I would say that none of the arguments have any basis. Mr. Flood was the victim of a reserve clause which, in my view, violates all of the antitrust statutes.